Welcome to Pleasant Ridge Today, the official podcast of Pleasant Ridge Waldorf School in Viroqua, Wisconsin. I'm Robin Kotke.
I'm David Levin.
Good morning, David.
Morning.
We have a really special guest today, Maureen Karlstad, veteran PRWS teacher, and her daughter, Martha Karlstad. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming to talk to us. When we first started the podcast about a year ago, we were most excited about the interview process for lots of different folks who have been involved with Pleasant Ridge over the years. And we haven't done as many as we've liked, but this is one in particular that we've been looking really forward to, because this is, now there are three generations of Karlstads at Pleasant Ridge. We're celebrating our 40th year this year. It's a major milestone event for us. And we wanted to bring Maureen and Martha just to talk about what that experience has been like.
So I thought that my mom and I could start with some basic introductions. So I can go first.
Okay.
So I'm Martha. I'm the daughter in the mother-daughter duo here. And I have a kindergartner, Luke, and a second grader, John, currently at Pleasant Ridge. And I am not an alum, but I have three siblings who went to Pleasant Ridge, Eamon, Brendan, and Maggie. And in the 97-98 school year, I was a nanny for a third and fourth grader in the school when Eamon was in kindergarten and Brendan was, I think, in seventh grade, and you were teaching. And so that was my most robust experience with Pleasant Ridge since I was graduated from high school, I think, when you started teaching there. So I did not have the opportunity to be a student myself. And we moved back after I finished my medical residency training in 2014. We moved back up north to Wisconsin. And a big part of why we moved back was so that our children would have the opportunity to go to Pleasant Ridge. And it's been great. So I thought it would be, because you've had so many roles over the years, I thought your introduction would be great if you could include kind of when you started and all of the various hats you've worn in those decades.
Okay. Do you want me to start with Pleasant Ridge or how I got to Pleasant Ridge? I can do that.
Ooh, how you got to Pleasant Ridge.
Well, we lived in North Dakota, a place I'm happy to say I don't live in anymore, especially in weather like this. It's cold there. It is cold. And I grew up in Ohio. So we moved here for me to take a job in special education in the Richland School District. I had a master's degree in special ed that I had worked on while we were living in North Dakota. And we wanted to move someplace in between Ohio and North Dakota, and this is about right in the middle. So we brought our family down here, and I worked in Richland Center for 4 years doing special ed. It was not my first calling. Waldorf education became my real calling, which I found out after I had taken a break when our youngest son, Eamon, was born. I stayed home with him for a few years and then wanted to get back into teaching. And I looked for jobs, and I applied for jobs in the public school, and I found out about Pleasant Ridge hiring. So I applied for both jobs. And the special ed job was not offered to me because I was too qualified, and they would have had to pay me more money than someone who had just gotten out of graduate school or with a bachelor's. So that was not even offered to me. And the job at Pleasant Ridge was, and I was so happy that I didn't even have to think about it. I just wanted to be here. And I think I told Martha before that I came to Pleasant Ridge earning half as much as I would have if I'd gotten a public school job, which I didn't get, by the way, but and I was much happier, just much happier. It was a real, it's been a really good fit for my philosophy of teaching.
And that was 93?
That was in 93.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've taken two classes through with a sabbatical in between. Back in the day when we actually decided we could afford a sabbatical, there were a couple of us that were able to do that. And then when it came time for a third class, I took a year off and decided that I would be the enrollment coordinator and wanted to help with that. And Betty Link, who had taken classes through the same time as I did at Prairie Hill Waldorf School, moved here. And so then she took the class that theoretically I would have taken, and it was a wonderful fit, and now she's living here too. Oh, and retired also now.
That's a win-win. And when you say taking a class all the way through, that means taking it through
first
full
through eighth grade.
Years. Great.
Your first class also started mm-hmm. first grade?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
After a while, I joined the faculty council once I got to know the lay of the land and realized where my help could be useful. And then I became faculty chair for a while. Then I was on the budget committee. I'm trying to think of all the different jobs I've had. I enjoyed the budget committee. Really. It was wonderful. A wonderful place where people made it work and for everybody. And then when I decided that I didn't want to work full-time anymore, I said I would do the enrollment job. And I really enjoyed doing that. I did that for 4 years. I didn't want to be the administrator. Full-time administrator. I thought I told people if I'm going to work full-time at Pleasant Ridge, I want to teach. And sure. That's when I decided to move into working in my studio more and teaching there. So that's what I've been doing. And except that right now I'm helping out in the fifth grade as the interim teacher.
You felt called again.
I felt called again.
You're literally called again.
Marie, they literally, yes, indeed.
Yeah, there's a running joke about our parents being, you know, not able to retire. They just can't.
People keep calling us. Mm-hmm. But 1 year, it's a 1 year commitment. Mm-hmm. In case you're wondering.
Yes, it's been such a gift. David's daughter is in that class, and
yeah.
Maureen has worked with three other teachers to help hold down the fort and. What a great year they've had.
It's been good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very appreciative of
yes.
you doing that.
Thank
for
you
sure.
for stepping up.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that's really, I think, from listening to you talk, draws you to the school in particular is your focus on the children and what's really in their best interest as they grow and learn. And I think that's what calls you back. You know, when you do get those calls, is you're generally swayed by what the kids need.
Yes,
yeah,
I would have to agree with that.
That was more of a rhetorical question.
Yes,
than
indeed.
Anything else. But one of the things that I think that you that's pretty interesting and unique is that you have this background in special education, both with your master's degree, but also your work experience in the public school. And the perspective that that gives you on normal and abnormal development and how that pairs so nicely with the Waldorf approach to education, which is rooted entirely in child development. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
I really enjoyed the people I worked with in the public school system. There are so many wonderful people doing wonderful things. It wasn't as good a fit for me because of my philosophy. But I also watched wonderful teachers struggle with some of the things they were asked to do. For instance, having kindergartners sit at a desk and take a standardized test. And they knew it wasn't helpful, but it was something they were mandated to do. So they did the best that they could with what they had. And I so appreciate that, but I just felt there was a better way. And being able to allow a child to develop at their own pace is such a gift. And I had, when I worked in the special ed, I also had that ability because the children I worked with had so many difficulties. People were very open to however it might work for them. So I could do that. I could give them the time they needed. They didn't have to learn how to read when they were in first grade in my classroom. Mm-hmm. I could focus on other things and not worry so much about it. And that was also because I carried the children through. So special ed was probably the best fit for me in the public school system because I was able to follow children and work with them at their own pace.
Oh, over the course of many years, like you would
right.
with the Waldorf model too.
Right. So that really helped. But then when I the thing that was hard for me is that after working in the special ed program, I had ideas and I knew what I thought would work well. But I had administrators who weren't so interested because there's no model in the public school for teachers having that kind of input. Mm. And that's when I left.
That kind of freedom. Mm-hmm. And right. In teaching, because you have to check certain boxes first.
And it's the it's a wonderful thing. It's also very difficult. But for the teachers to have that involvement in how the school is run is a crucial piece for me, that we take responsibility. It's a big responsibility. But we say, this is how we think it works best. And we'll carry it through. There's such a different approach to your work when you have that kind of investment in it.
Mm. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And you carry it, and you know, and you study, and you all work together on a very deep level. It's just a very different approach.
That's interesting, because I always think about the difference in Waldorf and, well, I assume public. I have no experience with that with our children. It's just about the experience for the kids, but I never really think about, well, I guess I think of some of the parent community also. Mm-hmm. But I never really think about the difference between the public schools and just how the school is run and how the teachers are involved and the liberties they're given. That's really interesting to think about. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I want to circle back to is reading, because that's a perennial conversation in Waldorf communities.
I was just thinking about that.
And I'm curious how given your background in special education and what you saw there, and then coming to Waldorf education, do you think that influenced your initial reaction to how they approach reading? Or do you think it would have been, yeah. How did you respond to that?
My interest in education goes way back to my bachelor's degree from the University of North Dakota, which had a very progressive education department. And I knew early on that the whole argument between phonics and whole language learning, if you are familiar with those terms.
Which continues to this day.
It was always a false dichotomy. There's no such thing as one way in which children learn. And to say one way is better than the other when you need to have all these ways to work with children to help them approach a subject was always ludicrous to me. So, and that was reinforced with the program I was at in the University of North Dakota. So I've always felt that children come to reading at their own, as a big one, come to reading at their own pace, and you facilitate that. And I've told people before that the majority of children will learn no matter how you work with them. They'll just pick it up. If they have some guided instruction, it could be in a lot of different ways, and they'll pick it up. There's children who will pick it up without you. There's a small group of them. They're just going to figure it out whether you tell them about it or not. Some children read when they're 3 and 4 just by watching the signs on the road. And they just do. They learn without any teaching. And then there's other children who are going to have a hard time no matter what you do. And those are the children you really need to help and you need to give the time to, because they'll come to it. Because if they're not frustrated and if they don't give up. So it's so important for that small group that you encourage them, but you don't overwhelm them and you allow them to come to it. I had children read much later than first or second grade, and they're avid readers still. They haven't lost their love of the written word because they were allowed to just come to it on their own.
Well, a lot of the Waldorf approach is anchored in preserving and fostering a love of learning as well, yes. Not just around reading.
Yeah.
And I would also say that the integrated approach and the interdisciplinary approach, there are so many precursors to reading and, you know, the verses and the games and just all of the different things that lead to.
And the storytelling.
And the storytelling that lead to reading. So that by the time, I would say that this is the one thing that we too were somewhat dubious about, because it's just so different from our own experience. Just feeling worried, you know, especially when we would get around other children who were younger than ours. And, you know, we would get questions like, well, what do you mean they're not, you know, reading yet? And it's like, well, here's what they are doing, you know, because yes, they can, but, you know, would they really be comprehending? Would they really have that same level of engagement? And now on the other side of it, I can say that when our oldest daughter started reading, she took right off and she loves reading. And it just, it was not the chore. It was something that they really looked forward to.
Some of the wonderful things that happen in Waldorf schools, like teaching knitting in first grade, they've done scientific research now showing the connection between work with your hands and ability in academic areas. Reading specifically, they've actually studied. I could get research for you if you really wanted it, but they just, a lot of the things that are done in Waldorf schools that seems so intuitive to us have actually been shown to work through scientific research, which is another wonderful thing, because now we have this whole body, 100 years of people experimenting, so to speak, and saying, oh, I wonder if this would work, and trying it out and saying, oh, look, anecdotally, yes, of course this works. But now people are really taking that up.
Well, and another piece that I think sometimes can feel a little more abstract and harder to measure is the development of critical thinking skills that occurs, I think, at Pleasant Ridge more intentionally than I think we might be aware of. I mean, how intentional is that, is my question, the development and fostering of critical thinking skills?
We bring in everything we do. So we don't, there's a lot of things that we do in the, say, math, for instance, which is an area where you can imagine wanting to work on critical thinking skills, that the idea that there's one answer to a problem can really steer you in the wrong direction, especially if you can't get that one answer yet. But the idea that you can figure out an answer and that there might be more than one way to figure out an answer is a much more useful skill to have. Maybe you don't know 7 times 8 yet. But maybe you can, you know, maybe you know when to use it, which is a much more important thing. Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to add, subtract, multiply, or divide here? So all of those things that we focus on, as well as using the tools that we have at our disposal for those concrete things, like, yes, times tables are important because they make it so much more fun. And so you can really go places with it, rather than having this rote thing that you just have to know because your teacher said so. So that's one area where we really want the children to learn how to think about this topic. And you can apply that to any topic that we bring. The more you can get them thinking about it. The whole science program is really about helping the children discover the underlying principle. So you do a demonstration, and then you come back the next day and you say, what did you see? And I remember one time, the day before, we had done something with physics, something with heat, probably boiled some water. And so I had a cup on the counter. And the next day when we came back and I said, well, what did you see? Well, there was a cup of water on the table half full. I said, how did you know it was water? Describe what you actually saw. And they said, oh, a cup of clear liquid, half full. So that's the kind of thinking you're really trying to help them to develop. Don't just assume. And a lot of kids come in with all these memes out there about scientific knowledge, and they'll tell you something about it, but they don't really understand it. So we really try and have them come to a realization that you can know this. You don't have to just memorize a fact about something scientific. You can see how it happens. You know, looking at it, describe what a candle is. That's one of the most fascinating things you can do. It's just a candle. What's really going on? And when you help children realize that, you've really opened up a world. We're not training scientists. We're not training mathematicians in particular. We're training them so that they can choose which one of those wonderful fields they wanted to go into. And everyone has an understanding of what a scientific principle is. Everyone has a feeling for language so that they take that into the world with them and they're well-rounded.
I think they can really see that too, and it's fascinating to think about. But in the approach to drawing and painting compared to the typical well, you know, I was exposed to it. It's like you're, you know, draw this, right? Draw the house or whatever the object is. And it's so much different in the Waldorf way. It's so much about discovering what these colors are about. And can you talk to that a little bit, just the approach of the intentionality behind the way you teach the drawing and painting?
We teach it as a skill like other skills. It's not an optional skill. So you can't say, well, I'm no good at drawing, I don't have to. I say, well, would you say that about reading? I'm no good at reading, so I don't have to. So we think of drawing and painting the same way, that you will hopefully leave the school with a rudimentary ability to do these activities. It may not be your preference in life. You're not going to be an artist, but you could probably draw a likeness of something. You can probably use perspective in a drawing accurately, because we feel that those are skills that you can use in getting to know the world. So we teach them as if there's something worth knowing and understanding and using. So there's that part of it. There's also just underlying beauty involved in it, like using colors and letting colors speak to you and coming. So in the earliers, for sure, it's all about getting to know a feeling for the colors. Can I give a real quick example? I don't think two children involved will mind. I won't mention them, but... So in first grade, I told a story about the color red, and the color red is just this exuberant color. It just loves to do things, and it's all out in the world. And I kind of went overboard in my story about how exuberant red was. And then one of the children in the class just got red everywhere. Got red all over the paper, all over, you know, just... And then at the end of the day... The moms are coming to pick them up, and the two children are standing there. And one of them, who, you know, heard the same story but had no paint anywhere, and the other one was just full of paint. And the one of the moms said, "Did they both paint?" And I toned it down a little bit the next time, but just, you know, everyone has a different way of expressing themselves. And it was okay. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, you bring things to the children, and you let them meet it where they are. So you bring those kinds of activities. And then there's a point, so coming back to drawing and painting, there's a point after the 9-year change, which we could talk about, where children really see the world differently, and they want to be able to do things correctly more. They're not living in this, you know, world of color and line, and it's just all beautiful. They think, no, it doesn't look like what I want it to look like, which is a time when we can bring those skills. How do you accurately draw something? What are some of the techniques for using with painting that can really help you achieve something you want to achieve, rather than just having the experience of the color or the line? And I find that children really like being able to do that. I mean, we bring in things like drawing from something, drawing from nature. We use grids to help them really start to really look. And I see it as more of a way of helping them be more scientific as well through the arts. So you talked about the integration. Mm-hmm. Learning to observe something by drawing it is an amazing skill. Because you really have to look at it. What's really in there? So it all works together so well. But you have to cut me off here.
But you do bring up something that's so interesting. And I remember Mr. Shermer talking about our approach to science and how really it's so rooted in observation early on, because the way of experiencing that, instead of saying, well, what's really happening here is, you know, condensation, really an emphasis on truly experiencing what's actually happening.
One of the most profound things I ever taught was the idea that you can't see light. You bring that to a seventh grader. Mm-hmm. You can't see light. And then all of a sudden we all think about it. And then we talk about, what does that mean? how does, you know, and then we have all the, we darken the room so there's absolutely no light if we can make it happen. And we say, how long would it take for your eyes to get used to no light at all? I mean, there's just so many directions you can go in. Science can be so profound so quickly that you bring that inspiration. And then then you can tell the children, well, maybe you'll find out more about that when you, if you take up this field later in life. And then they think about that. Huh. That would be interesting. So the scientific approach that we use just is so all-encompassing. It's just another way of looking at the world, the same way art is, the same way language is, same way reading is, math. They're all just ways of looking at the world, and the overlap is just there to be noted.
The pace is also, I think, worth discussing, because there, you know, we can talk about it as rhythm, we can talk about it as pace, right? But there is there's a lot of intention brought to how the day is structured to allow for that
breathing in and out. I
indeed, yes, I'm doing the hand motion.
So you might do something really active, and then right after that, do something very quiet.
Mm-hmm. And that continues through the grades, correct?
It does. In different ways because of where the children are at. Mm-hmm. Although even with a group of adults, if you've been sitting and talking and listening, after an hour or so, you should get up and sing a song. Do some jumping jacks. Something to change the pace, and then you can get back, you can sit back down again refreshed. So it's that whole same idea that we all need that ebb and flow. Mm-hmm. We don't want to just keep, and in our day and age, it's so easy to just get sucked into something that we're doing. Oh, I just, you know, 5 more minutes and I'll be done. And 2 hours later, oh, right. I should have taken a break in there.
That happens to other people?
Oh. It does, indeed.
Thank goodness.
But when you structure the day so that it can't be that way, it can be a beautiful thing.
Sure.
And it's nice when someone structures it for you so you don't even have to think about it. You just move in and out of the things. Mm-hmm. If you ever want to bring a group of adults together, just start singing a song. Because it just, even if they didn't go to a Waldorf school, they'll stop and think. And all of a sudden you have their attention in a way you didn't before.
And that ebb and flow involves the outdoors quite a bit.
Yes, it does.
And hands-on work is part of that ebb and flow as well.